The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate this week to have Adam Ware back with us, cardiologist extraordinaire and genuine good egg. Adam's put a lot of effort into this particular episode. Before we start, Adam, do you have any thing that you'd like to disclose, or do you have any conflicts of interest?
No disclosures and no conflicts of interest.
Nothing has changed since last week.
Nothing.
Would you like us to find some conflicts for you?
No, I think conflict-free is generally better.
It's definitely better to be uncomplicated. Well, what we wanted to do this week is to try to, and I should give credit where credit is due. A lot of this is in response to a request from extraordinary pediatrician Lulu Waterhouse, who said, you know, it'd be great if we get Adam Ware to talk about a cardiac exam and give us a refresher on cardiac auscultation. And Adam, you've been very kind to put a lot of effort into putting this together. We actually want to have some heart sounds that people can listen to and go back and listen to. And we should probably give credit there. Where do these heart sounds come from? I know from hearts, but...
from heart. So this is a library that I use most commonly. It's the Michigan Heart Sounds Library. And if anybody's interested, they can just Google that and it pops right up. It was built by Dr. Mangrokar and Judge in Michigan. It's an open access library, so we have permission to use these sounds, but it's a great resource, and I think it's based on adult heart sounds, so there is a caveat in terms of, you know, the speed of the heart, but the same types of sounds we hear in adults are super common in kids, and so we'll play sounds from that library, but that's where it comes from, and if you want to access it, like I said, you can just put that into a Google search, Michigan Heart Sounds Library, and it'll pop right up.
And, but in addition to that, of course, if you like to hear these sounds with expert annotation by Dr. Adam Ware, just keep listening, because that's what we're going to talk about right now.
Yeah, we're going to try to plug them right into the podcast. And so I think that as you listen to this, high quality audio is obviously important. So if you're in a car and you're like, I can't hear anything, maybe listen to it again with headphones in. I think that may make a difference as you try to listen to these murmur sounds.
Which is not that different from what happens in the average exam room with six other kids in the room and somebody grabbing onto you while you're listening.
Yeah, I think that cardiac auscultation is really challenging physical exam, and it's challenging to be good at it. I think that we don't hear sounds that we aren't listening for. Our mind is so good at tuning out what it interprets as noise. I think that all of us have had the experience of sitting in a location and not hearing some of the things around us because we're focused. There are so many sounds going on when you put a stethoscope onto the chest of a child. You hear, like you said, other people in the room. I'm amazed at how many people want to talk to me when I'm trying to listen to their heart. You hear kids crying. You hear noises from bumping the stethoscope. You hear breath sounds. You'll hear heart sounds. And it's really a symphony of noise. I often, this is maybe exposes me as a nerd, but I often tell our learners that it's like a symphony. It's like sitting in a symphony and trying to pick out the cello and isolating every other sound. That's really what you need to do to listen to the heart well. And just like reading an EKG or going through any other examination practice, I think that having a set way that you do it is really helpful. So we'll talk about each of these different components, but when I listen to the heart, I focus on S1 individually, and then I focus on S2 individually. I try to hear any mid-systolic sounds, and then I try to hear murmurs, systolic and diastolic. And so that's the practice that I use in every location as I listen to the heart. Obviously, you get faster when you have done it, but putting a stethoscope on the chest and listening without really actively engaging is not super useful. I don't think we find physical exam findings that we aren't actively looking for.
And so what sorts of things do you want to know before you start listening to someone's heart?
Yeah, that's a really great question. A history can key you into possible problems. I also think that there are just visual examination findings that could key you into a problem, right? Obviously, color, nail beds, there's all of these other findings that can tip you off that there may be an issue, the cardiac examination. Any child who has a genetic syndrome or looks like they may have a genetic syndrome, I would be particularly careful in listening to their hearts. Family history can be a big tip off in terms of there are common things that run in families. Bicuspid aortic valves, for example, we think about having a family incidence of about 10%. So those types of questions, before you even listen to the heart, can clue you into the likelihood that you're going to hear something.
Let's talk a little bit about what we're hearing when we're listening to heart sounds. What are the heart sounds?
Yeah, so like I said, when we listen to a normal heart, most often we're hearing valve closures, right? So we talk about S1 and S2. S1 is happening at the beginning of systole, and S2 is happening at the end of systole, the beginning of diastole. So the S1 heart sound is, so when we are listening to the heart sounds, we are listening primarily to valve closures, unless there is a murmur, and then that is blood flow moving through the heart. So when we talk about S1, that is the closure of the AV valves, so the mitral and tricuspid valves. And that heart sound happens at the beginning of systole. And then the second heart sound is the closure of the pulmonary valve and the aortic valve. And so that is the end of systole, obviously the beginning of diastole, where the AV valves are open and filling again. So those are the sounds that we hear. In addition to S1 and S2, sometimes we can hear the mid-systolic clicks that may represent a problem with a valve opening. The mid-systolic clicks, I think about those, you know, with a bicuspid aortic valve, for example. When we hear that, we hear S1 and then an opening click, oftentimes the valve is stiff. I think of it like those little rubber balls that you turn inside out and set them on a table and they jump up. I wish I had a picture of them to show you, but I think most of us have played with those. And the valve is kind of deforms like that. So when there's pressure from below, it has to deform into an open position. And then when there's pressure from above during diastole, that aortic valve deforms again. But we hear that opening click.
It's a great illustration. That is terrific.
We have some of these sounds that we can go over. This first one, normal S1 and S2, I only play it. We've all heard it. I only play it so that people get a sense of what they might sound like on these examples that we're going to give. So here's just an example from the Heart Sounds Library of a normal S1 and S2. So not anything complicated there. The second heart sounds that we're talking about, S2, is really informative. And I think that when people listen to the heart, they're often only listening for murmurs, but the valves opening and closing give us a lot of information about what's going on. The next thing that I listen for when in the valve sounds is the second heart sound. And I want to know if that second heart sound is single, if I can't hear it splitting at all. Most of the time in kids, we will hear a physiologic split. And the physiology behind that is that as we take a deep breath, we increase the preload to the right side of our heart. And so it takes the right ventricle a split second longer to eject the blood. And so that split second is noticed in comparison to the aortic valve. For these physiologic splits, you will hear them split after the child has taken a breath. And this is an example of that physiologic split.
Almost sounds a little like an echo, doesn't it?
Yeah, so that's, and again, this is in adults. And so the hard part with the exam in children is that everything is much faster. But on this example, if you'll listen carefully, you'll hear a single, or not single is the wrong terminology, but a joined second heart sound for three beats, and then for, there's a few beats of a split second heart sound, and then it goes back to three beats of a not split second heart sound. Single second heart sound is a terminology we often use in kids with really severe congenital heart disease who have essentially one semilunar valve, and you truly don't have a second S2 sound. So, you know, when I describe these in my notes, I talk about there is no splitting of the second heart sound. The physiologic splitting, I think that is a normal benign finding. So if you hear it come and go, there's really not any reason to be nervous about that. That is in comparison to a fixed split second heart sound. And when we think about a fixed split second heart sound, we're really thinking about volume load to the right side of the heart that is consistent. Unlike the physiologic split, where you get a volume load that is transient based on the breathing pattern of the child, with a fixed split second heart sound, you have a chronic constant volume overload. So the most classic example of that is an atrial septal defect. So with an ASD, you always have extra blood to the right side of the heart. It doesn't matter what phase of the respiratory cycle you're in. Other systemic venous malformations can cause that. So anything that causes a volume load to the right side of your heart will cause the fixed split second heart sound. And that sounds just like this. In children, that splitting second heart sound, you know, as you talk about additional heart sounds like S3 and S4 and gallops, I think that those can be hard to distinguish. Essentially, you have to identify S1 and S2 and then figure out where the extra sound is coming in relation to S1 and S2. And easier said than done. I think that the message would be, if you are hearing that sound, a referral is probably warranted, even if the child doesn't have a murmur, because with atrial septal defects, you don't always have a murmur. Sometimes you only hear the splitting of the second heart sound. If I hear that, I have the luxury of just getting an echo immediately in my clinic. I typically will order an echo on kids where I hear that. The other challenge is often identifying that split S2 sound versus the mid-systolic clicks. The mid-systolic clicks typically happen earlier and more often more closely associated with S1. So here's an example from the Michigan Heart Sounds Library about a mid-systolic click. So the mid-systolic click, like I said, those are challenging to hear. But if you hear that, you should immediately think of a bicuspid aortic valve. That is the sound of a bicuspid aortic valve. We often see that with mitral valve prolapse as well. And so in either situation, an echocardiogram is probably warranted. So if you are hearing a fixed splitting or a mid-systolic heart sound, or you're not sure which one it is, a referral is probably the right thing to do to make sure that there isn't some pathology causing that abnormal valve opening.
And that's very helpful.
In addition to the heart sounds of the valves, focusing next on the murmur that can be associated with those sounds can be really helpful to identify what is potentially going on.
And with the murmur, now we're hearing the flow and turbulence in flow, right?
Yep, exactly. So when I describe murmurs to families, I think of murmurs, again, as the norm in children. I think that in most children, you will likely hear a murmur at some point during their life. And so more often than not, murmurs are benign. So the real secret is identifying the ones that are abnormal. When I talk to families and try to get them to understand that, because, you know, if you're taking a family history about cardiac conditions, everybody says, great aunt Ethel had a murmur. And you're like, right. I don't know what that means. I don't know what, she always had a murmur. And I try to teach them that a murmur is not a diagnosis, that a murmur is a physical exam finding. And the analogy that I use with them that I think is the most useful is comparing it to a garden hose, which sounds crazy, but I tell them that when you have a garden hose turned on, you can hear water flowing through it, right? If your child turned on a garden hose, you don't need to see it, you can just hear it. You know that there is flow moving through that hose. When there is a bend in the hose, a kink in the hose, the water has to move more quickly through a narrowed area, and it sounds much different. So when I turn on a hose, I know right away whether the flow is normal through that hose or whether there is a problem with the flow in that hose. And that's the way that I describe benign versus pathologic murmurs to them. And parents, I feel like, for the most part, understand that. I feel like that's a common experience that people have, and they're like, oh, like, it's just a sound. I get it. And we're making judgments based on a sound. Because inevitably, whenever people come to the cardiologist, they want an echo, right? They want to say, well, let's just get an echo to make sure. And that's not necessarily the wrong thing to do. It's just, you know, the pretest probability should probably inform our decision-making when we're getting tests.
Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties that I think we have with discussing murmurs is that we try to describe them. So one of the things I think is great about what you're doing today is that we try to use vocabulary to discuss what we're hearing, but I think it helps, you know, what's harsh, what's musical, what's vibratory, what does all that mean? Let's talk about it. Now, there's also a lot of importance about when the murmur occurs too.
Yeah, we'll break down the murmurs and how I think is best to describe them. You're right that the terminology when it comes to murmurs is, I think that it tries to be helpful, but it often is more confusing than helpful. I mean, I've read textbooks that describe murmurs like the wind through the trees or the strumming of a bass fiddle. And I'm like, I don't know what that means.
That is so poetic. I should interject here, Adam. I'm always reminded of what's probably an apocryphal quote because it's been attributed to a lot of people. But someone once said that writing about music is like dancing about architecture. And I think describing sounds is really difficult. And so this helps. So thank you.
And I hope that the sounds work out, because oftentimes when I'm in a lecture and I try to describe heart sounds, the audio just doesn't work. So I end up essentially beatboxing the murmurs, and that's
so, wait, I want to hear that.
that is not.
Can we make that bonus material?
Yeah. All Caucasian gentlemen from central Utah is not good at beatboxing. No offense to any tall Caucasians from central Utah that are good at beatboxing. So when I think of the murmurs and the sounds, the way that we describe them, I don't like terminology like blowing, you know, harsh, grating. Harsh and vibratory, I think, are useful. I think all of us understand like a more pleasant noise versus a more unpleasant noise. And when you listen to a heart, you might hear that. So blowing is not a term that I commonly use, and I don't know what that means. But I try to focus on the frequency or the pitch of the murmur. And what I mean by that is the same thing with the hose analogy, right? As that narrowing, or as that area that blood is flowing through becomes smaller, or as a pressure difference is higher on, you know, creating a faster flow of blood, the frequency or the pitch of the murmur increases. So it just sounds faster. And if you have a system that is wide open, where there's not a big pressure difference between the sides, or a hole that's really large, then the blood doesn't have to move fast through there. And so it doesn't sound as harsh, as high frequency. But again, those are hard terms to describe. But I do try to say low frequency, mid frequency, or high frequency. And sometimes I get like, I don't know how to describe this, and I'll say low to mid. Or, you know. So I think they're giving a range is okay.
I just tell the viola using your listening to things in the symphony.
So I do think that trying to describe the murmur is helpful to, you know, the physician that receives the referral, just because they kind of want to know what you heard, because murmurs can change over time as well. So I talk about the frequency of the murmur, and then I talk about the grade of the murmur. And the grading system, they describe a 1 to 6 grading system, where they say, you know, 1 is you just barely hear it. 2, it's more noticeable. 3, it's louder. I think that the way that I like to think about that, to try to put some clear markers on what it means, is I compare it to the valve sounds themselves, right? So 1 for me is softer than the valve sound closure. 2 is about as loud as the valve sound, and 3 is louder. 4, if you want to have a grade 4 murmur, you have to have a thrill associated with it, and all murmurs are thrilling. I'm sure that your listeners will agree. But a thrill is that vibratory sensation that you hear or that you feel with your fingers. So it's a tactile physical exam finding. So if somebody has a really high frequency murmur, put your hand on their chest and you might actually feel the vibrations from that super fast blood. A grade 5 murmur, you know, they say, you know, you put your stethoscope on the chest at an angle so it's not really touching the chest and you'll hear it. And a grade 6 is the, you know, you walk into the room, you're like, whoa, you got a murmur. So I don't often see cardiologists in my group, at least, identifying grade 6 murmurs. I think that if you're at a 3 or 4, everybody recognizes it's a noisy, significant murmur. Diastolic murmurs, I mean, I've seen them graded 1 to 4. I don't think that we are going, you're never going to have a thrill associated with a diastolic murmur. I would be shocked if you ever had blood moving that quickly. So mostly I think of diastolic murmurs as present or absent. If you hear a diastolic murmur, it's never normal. So when I am thinking about the murmur and describing it, I talk about a frequency, a grade, and then a location. And the location is really important as well. You know, I think that we get a little bit stuck in, okay, if it's right upper sternal border, it's aortic. Left upper sternal border is pulmonic. Left lower sternal border is tricuspid. And then at the apex of the heart, we're listening more to mitral. And that is generally true. But for little kids, these sounds radiate pretty commonly throughout their entire precordium. And so you can't, you know, if you hear a sound at the apex, it could very well be from the aortic valve. And I think of truly aortic sounds as happening more along kind of a band from the right upper down to the apex. I often hear bicuspid aortic valves better in the apex of the heart than I do even over the aortic valve. But those are generally good rules for the area that you're listening to. So describing the location and then finally describing any radiation. And the radiation can be really important. If it is radiating, if you hear a murmur at the apex that radiates up to the left axilla, that's likely a mitral valve murmur. If you're hearing it at, you know, an upper sternal border and then it goes up to the carotid arteries, that's likely aortic, right? If you're hearing it kind of upper sternal border and then it goes more to the axilla, that's probably a pulmonic sound and you're hearing it radiating out through the branch pulmonary arteries. So where it radiates to can give you clues as well as to the identity of, you know, the etiology of what's happening.
Where should we start? Should we go regionally?
Yeah, let's break down one more thing. So okay. when the phase of the cardiac cycle that we're in is really important too, right? And we've talked about systolic versus diastolic, diastolic being always abnormal. A systolic murmur, I think you need to break down further into a systolic ejection murmur versus a holosystolic murmur. And these, you know, these rules, I think they are good to learn by. They don't always hold. A systolic ejection murmur, I think of being able to hear the valve sounds around the murmur. You think of these as like aortic or pulmonic stenosis, where you hear the AV valves close, the pressure generates in the ventricle, and then, you know, a kind of a crescendo decrescendo murmur across the valve. And then you hear the semilunar valves close. So you hear those valve closure sounds. Compare that to like a holosystolic murmur, which is the other category, and where you hear the valve sounds, sometimes not at all, but they are obscured by the sound of the rushing blood. As soon as that left ventricle is squeezing, if you have a VSD, there is blood moving from one side of the heart to the other, so it obscures the sound of the AV valves close. And then it continues throughout systole, and then you don't hear the semilunar valves close either. So it's just a consistent murmur. So
Adam, let's dive in and listen to some murmurs. Let's start with what we hear probably most commonly, and those are some of the innocent murmurs. What are some of the murmurs that we hear that we should not worry about?
Yeah, so for something to be defined as an innocent murmur, I think that there are some criteria, right? So typically, if you're hearing a grade 3, you can have benign murmurs at grade 3. Sometimes some of these are quite loud, but typically you'll be hearing 2 or less. They should have a normal physical exam otherwise, nothing that is concerning to you. They should have if you were doing additional evaluations, a normal chest x-ray, a normal EKG, I think that those tests can be helpful. So I think if there's like a borderline chest x-ray plus a murmur, or if there's a borderline anything, I think of two red flags as somebody who gets an echo, in my opinion. But when we break down the benign murmurs, one of the most common ones that we hear is a Still's murmur. And Still's murmur is not equivalent to all benign murmurs. A Still's murmur is a very specific murmur that was described by Dr. George Still in the early 1900s. He originally thought that it was due to vibration of the mitral valve chordae, or even vibrations of what we call false tendons. There are these little strands that sometimes cross the left ventricle, and as the valves closed or as the left ventricle relaxed, they thought maybe those things were vibrating. There are some studies that those false tendons are more common when you have a Still's murmur. There's some other studies that suggest that it's probably just flow from your left ventricle into the LV outflow tract. But these murmurs are the pleasant sounding murmurs, as poor a description as that is. You know, it's the strummed bass fiddle. It's hard to describe these sounds, but it is a very characteristic sound.
But the beauty of this is you've got sounds.
I've got sounds, yeah. And the other physical exam finding is that these are typically louder when the patient is in supine. So you'll hear them best when the kid is lying down. So let's listen to that example of a Still's murmur. And I think, you know, that these examples certainly have their weaknesses. They're the best that I have ever found, to be honest, online. And I think that is a pretty good example of an innocent Still's murmur. It's not perfect. I will tell you, it's not perfect.
Let's say calling that musical is a little bit of a stretch, but I think it's music to your ears if you know that it's not worrisome.
Yes. That is. So, this example, it's not quite a Still's murmur. It might even be a better example of a benign flow murmur, right? So a flow murmur is probably more common than a Still's murmur. And the flow murmur is just exactly what it sounds like. It's turbulent flow across the valve that does not meet any threshold for intervention. And you could watch this for a long time. Typically, as kids grow, they go away. Hearing it on the speakers in the room right now, it might be a better example of a flow murmur. So a good example of that would be peripheral pulmonic stenosis in newborns, right? PPS is super common. We typically hear it around 2 to 3 months old. It should go away after 3 or 4 months. What happens is that in utero, you're only getting about 10% of the blood flow through the main pulmonary artery that goes to the lungs. The rest of it, you know, 90% of the blood that's coming through there is going through the PDA out to the body. So when you have the PDA close and those pulmonary blood vessels are now responsible to, you know, accept 100% of the blood flow through the MPA, 100% of the cardiac output, that's a stretch for them. And literally they do need to stretch. So the turbulent flow of a lot of volume in a small vessel is what creates that PPS murmur. And it's super common. You'll hear it radiate out to the axilla, sometimes into the back because the left pulmonary artery dives more posterior instead of like straight to your axilla. But that, you know, that sound we just played is probably a better suggestion of a PPS type murmur.
And what should reassure me about that? Is it both the radiation and the quality, or is it?
Yes. So the fact that it's happening in an age group where we would expect it, the fact that the frequency of the murmur sounds quite low. So, you know, that doesn't sound like the blood is moving really fast across a valve. The grade is low in a kid who's doing really well. So I think that all of those things can be reassuring, and you know, you could safely watch that murmur. I will throw a caveat out there that as a cardiologist, we are never upset by murmur referrals, right? We understand that these things are dynamic and changing, and it's you know, we have a very low threshold to do echocardiograms in infants. And so for pediatricians referring to specialists, if you're unsure or uncomfortable with the murmur, you know, don't hesitate to let us know, because I think that a diagnosis of a benign murmur in cardiology clinic is much better than missing a pathologic heart condition.
And infants are tough. They, for one thing, they are, as a class, poor historians. But the other part of it is that they really come, despite the fact that they've usually had an ultrasound before they were born, they really come without a lot of history. And so I think that an infant cardiac exam can be terrifying.
Yeah. And their circulation is dynamic, right? So their PDA is closing, their pulmonary vascular resistance is dropping. There's a lot of things going on that a kid who is doing okay in the first week of life might not be doing okay in the second or third week of life. And so that's why if there are concerns, we are always happy to see them, and we try to get them in quickly if there are concerns from the pediatrician.
We appreciate that. Well, so now, do you want to touch on a venous hum? I've never...
Yeah, venous hums are hard. So if you listen consistently to your kids as they are sitting up, just under the clavicles, you can often hear flow from the venous system. So in the jugular veins, flow returning down to the SVC. These murmurs will go away as a child moves their head or when they lay down. So if you have them sit up and you hear a murmur and then they look at their mom and the murmur goes away, that's probably a venous hum. And these can be systolic. This is the one situation where you could have sounds during diastole that might be benign. They are fairly common if you're looking for them, but have kids move their head around, and if it goes away, it's nothing to be worried about.
Well, so now let's talk about some worrisome murmurs. And it seems like maybe the best way to approach this would be to take a regional approach. I think that we try to do that when we listen to hearts so that we have some idea what we're listening to. Let's start with the right upper sternal border. What are we listening to there?
Yeah, it's like we talked about. That's kind of the aortic listening post. But remember, the aortic sounds can be transmitted, from the right upper sternal border down towards the apex. But typically, if you're hearing a systolic murmur that is higher frequency there, or a mid-systolic sound, that's when I'm more worried about aortic pathology. I think that this sound is a good example of aortic stenosis, which is quite common in kids. So that sound, again, defining that sound, I would say that is a systolic ejection murmur, because you clearly hear S1 and S2 around it. Mm-hmm. I would call that mid-frequency, because it doesn't sound, you know, it sounds like the blood is moving faster than we would expect. Obviously, there's a murmur there, but it's not a low-frequency sound. And that, I think that's a pretty reasonable example of systolic murmur. The same thing could be said if you just move, you know, across to the left upper sternal border, where you're listening over the pulmonary valve. If you hear that type of a murmur, then you could certainly be concerned about pulmonary pathology. The way to distinguish those two, like we talked about before, is radiation. So if I listen at the upper sternal borders and I can hear that murmur in both locations, and I'm not sure which valve may be affected, then I'll listen to the carotids, I'll listen to the axilla, and see where do I hear it best besides at the upper sternal borders. And that could be a clue as to aortic versus pulmonic pathology. The thing to contrast is, and what might dictate your referral, is just how fast you feel the blood is moving. It's hard to distinguish that from the previous murmur that we played and benign flow murmur versus a pathologic degree of stenosis. And sometimes if we are unsure, the echo helps us to decide whether they get followed or whether it's just a benign flow murmur. Mm-hmm. So moving along, you know, down along the left sternal border, we hear a lot of sounds along the left sternal border. You know, you're listening to the ventricular septum in that position. So we will commonly hear things like VSDs. we'll hear sometimes AV valve regurgitation, such as, you know, tricuspid valve regurgitation, although tricuspid valve regurgitation is actually quite hard to hear. You can hear sometimes other obstructive lesions that are in that area. Sometimes the obstruction, you know, there towards the upper sternal, the right upper sternal border of like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy can be heard. So there can be a lot going on along kind of the left sternal border. When I think of classic left sternal border murmurs, I think of Still's murmurs, and then I think of VSD murmurs. So a VSD murmur, like we talked about before, is going to be holosystolic. So let's compare this sound to the one that we just listened to for aortic stenosis. So again, this not being perfect, I think that you obviously hear S1 and S2 around this recording as well. But the murmur is a higher frequency, I would say. And sometimes, you know, if you can use your imagination, you won't hear S1 and S2 around that murmur. You hear only the high frequency sounds that are associated with that. And that is pretty classic for a VSD.
And at least you can't hear any differentiation from the heart sound to the murmur. Unlike the previous murmur where you could hear a heart sound and then the murmur would begin.
Yep, so it's happening from the beginning of S1 straight through to S2. You don't hear that. You know, people like to talk about murmurs in terms of like crescendo, decrescendo, and these murmurs should just be, they shouldn't be crescendo, decrescendo. They should be consistent throughout. And like I said, the classic VSD, you don't hear S1 and S2. That being said, there's a lot of shades of gray when we listen to heart murmurs, right? As you have the VSD close and there's less blood going through it, it's not as loud, the frequency might increase and it might have faster blood, but then you start to hear S1 and S2 more easily. So it's not like a hard and fast rule, but when I'm teaching, you know, residents that come to our clinic, that's how I describe it, just to give them kind of a framework to begin with. You know, the murmur sound in that example, I think, is a good example of a holosystolic murmur, not crescendo decrescendo, but just consistent throughout all of systole.
And far from musical.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I think that is pretty clearly the harsh sound. You know, it's not a pleasant sound.
No.
So, the wind blowing through the trees, you know, it's not that.
No, or leprechauns singing or
rainbows. Just think of rainbows falling on lilies.
The sound of a rainbow, there we go.
That, you know, I think is the left sternal border type murmurs. A lot of times people talk about dynamic obstruction in the left ventricular outflow tract and what are these provocative positions that we can put people in to try to evoke a murmur, right? And typically you don't need to do that for congenital heart diseases. I think of that more in relation to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And so if you see people, you know, having them squat down and then stand up, what you're trying to do is either alter the preload or the afterload of the heart to make that hypertrophic cardiomyopathy obstruction more present. So if you increase preload to the heart, what that does is it stretches, you know, you have increased filling. And so if you have increased filling, the heart is more open and you're going to not have the obstruction out the left ventricular outflow tract. That's why sometimes we'll put kids like this on beta blockers. In addition to the antiarrhythmic property, it increases their time to fill. If you increase afterload, it also makes it less likely that you will hear a murmur because their pressure gradient has decreased, right? So typically when a kid is squatting with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, you've done both. You've increased their preload and you've increased their afterload. So the murmurs of a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is going to be less audible. Then you have them stand up with your stethoscope on their chest. So now what you've done is you've decreased preload and you have decreased afterload as well. And so the heart is less full, so more likely to cause obstruction. And there is a bigger pressure difference between the LV and the systemic vascular resistance. And so again, more likely to hear a murmur. So those are the changes in positions, techniques, and what we are trying to accomplish. you know, I think that if somebody has a family history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that's somebody that should just be seen by a cardiologist.
Sure. Well. Sure. Right. And that's the contribution of a good history.
Yep.
What about diastolic murmurs?
Diastolic murmurs are always abnormal. And so if you think you are hearing something in diastole, then that kid should get a referral. So when we think about diastolic murmurs, most commonly we are probably hearing insufficiency of the aortic or pulmonic valves. Occasionally we'll have stenosis of the AV valve, so mitral or tricuspid. Those are harder sounds to hear. So if you want to hear the, you know, stenosis of the mitral valve, typically get the kid up into a left lateral decubitus position, listen with your bell, and you'll hear a kind of low rumbling diastolic murmur. But this is more of an example of a aortic or pulmonic insufficiency murmur. So let's listen to this example. So what you're hearing is, I mean, you hear S1 and S2 really clearly, and then right with S2, you hear kind of a decrescendo type murmur.
Where's my stethoscope right now when I'm listening to that murmur?
Typically, you'll hear that, again, depending on which valve is abnormal, either upper sternal border for aortic valve or pulmonic valve, right or left. And sometimes down into the apex as well. Like I said, those aortic sounds, you often hear them radiate down there. So if you hear anything in diastole, then like I just think that that is a kid who we would echo. The other times where we really commonly hear diastolic sounds are with a PDA. And I don't have great audio on this adult, you know, library for a PDA. But a PDA, I used to think, you know, it's that machine-like sound where you hear it throughout the cardiac cycle, systole and diastole. And it's not that the sound, it's not that the blood is changing directions through the PDA or anything like that. It can do that. But typically what you're hearing is, for most PDAs, they are left to right shunts because the systemic resistance is higher than the pulmonary resistance and blood just wants to flow to low resistance. But you hear changes in the pressure difference between your systemic and pulmonary vasculature. So you hear that kind of dual phased continuous murmur described as a machine-like murmur, really up at the left upper sternal border, even, you know, farther out. That is a pretty classic murmur that I think most pediatricians have probably heard, and something that, you know, if you're hearing that, obviously warrants a referral. Other special situations.
Although we may hear that in the nursery, and if it resolves, then that's okay, right?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. You know, other special situations like coarctation type murmurs. I think that part of the physical exam, and you'll save a kid's life if you do this, is just feeling upper and lower extremity blood pulses on all kids. And if you can't find them, getting an upper and lower extremity blood pressure. Coarctation murmurs are kind of classically along the left sternal border and then radiate into the back. Other special situations that kids with loud murmurs would be kids with surgical shunts. They will always have a murmur. And some of our single ventricle kids will have a really, really loud murmur. That really loud murmur is their only source of blood flow to their lungs. And so, you know, if you're following somebody between their Norwood procedure and their Glenn procedure and you feel like that murmur is changing or you don't hear it well, you know, if you don't hear it, the kid is probably really blue and in a very poor spot. But those are loud murmurs that we commonly hear as well. I guess commonly for a cardiologist and less frequently outside of cardiology clinic. The real secret to listening to murmurs, though, I think is just practice. And like I said, if you can commit yourself to describe it, and if you do it consistently, I think that you'll get good at it. It's like somebody who needs to be intubated. The learner will come in and be kind of timid about it and maybe not get the tube in. But by the time you've reached the attending trying to get it done, they'll take all the time they need and make sure that it gets in. Listening to a heart murmur is no different. I will listen to the heart for 30, seconds to a minute in each position. Sometimes I think parents are really worried that I'm hearing something abnormal, but I'm really just trying to be thorough and hear all of those different sounds that we've described.
Well, I think in many ways the take-home message from this is that for one thing, it's important that we all acquaint ourselves with careful listening skills and try to differentiate what doesn't sound right. But the other part of this is that this is clearly an area where collaboration and consultation is absolutely invaluable. I think that there have been a million times where my auscultation gets much better after I've referred somebody and I've see what the echo shows. Now I can tell exactly what's going on in the heart. But the key really is to have enough wherewithal to be able to say, this doesn't sound like I expect it to sound, and then to collaborate with somebody like you.
Yeah. I think that what you just described, you're ready to be a cardiologist. That's what we do. I mean, all of us document our physical exam before the echocardiogram in cardiology, right? We always describe the murmur perfectly before we know what it is. That's not true. We certainly don't do that. I think that the echo has influenced my interpretation of a sound more than once. So,
but it's changed everything, hasn't it? Because before echocardiograms, cardiologists really had to make a best guess based purely on auscultation. And now I think it's important for us to be good at auscultation so that we know which patients need to have a much better blueprint drawn of their heart.
Yeah. And I mean, some of my mentors in cardiology at the, when I was at the Mayo Clinic, there are physicians there who were very senior, and I worked in their clinics. They were the most amazing at listening to a heart and telling you exactly what it was. And they'd say, I don't need an echo. I'll tell you what the gradient is right now. I think that is a skill that we try to maintain in cardiology. But I do think that the, advance in technology, a lot of us rely on the echo. And like you said, it's a matter of identifying normal versus abnormal or concern for abnormal to make sure we get the right test done.
It was really, really my privilege when I was early in practice that George Vesey had an office upstairs. When I heard a murmur in clinic, he was kind enough. He would come down and listen. And mostly he would say, Paul, don't worry about that. That was very helpful. It was helpful to have somebody who was very skilled at knowing what he was listening to and listening carefully. And I think that it behooves us all with our physical exam skills generally to become familiar with what we're supposed to be seeing. And, when I said have the wherewithal to make the right call, a lot of times I think it's just the humility to say, I'm not exactly sure what's going on here, but I know that there are smart people who can help me figure this out.
Yeah.
Or smart. Thanks for being one of the smart people, Adam.
Smart machines make it happen.
No, thank you so much. This has been very, very helpful. I hope people can use this as a lasting resource to continue to sharpen their skills. Thanks for all the effort you've put into this. And most of all, thanks for what a great educator you are. I've seen you in many situations, and you're just a great teacher, and we appreciate that.
Well, it's kind of you. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. For all of you listening out there, make sure and send your questions to questions@thecurb.com. If you like what you're hearing, please review us and tell your friends. If you don't like what you're hearing, for goodness sake, just give me a call and let me know what we could be doing better. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting this podcast. Bye, Adam.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus,
who also composed the theme music. See you next time.